Good afternoon. It is 12:02, Friday afternoon. Like you just heard the forecast, not too much sunshine, but on the other hand, nothing's falling from the sky, so I'll take it. I'm Eric Scott. Good afternoon. Jeb Bradley will not be with us today. He is on another vacation. Brody Deshays has kindly volunteered to fill in for him. Hi, Brody.
Hi, Eric. How are you? And not too bad that we're going to be missing the senator today, but hopefully I can be capable enough and fill his large shoes.
Oh, I think you can. I'm not too worried about that. Everything so far go okay? I haven't seen you in a while.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen you in a little bit either, Eric, but it's been going great. Calling in today, I have a meeting at around 1 o'clock, so just got to make sure that I have enough time to jump onto that meeting. But, you know, it's going great.
Okay. Hey, I figured we'd start off with something fun. You had posted on Facebook the other day. You had been on an apple pie binge.
Yeah, no, I got an apple pie the other day. Me and my girlfriend, we did a drive up to, went up to Plymouth, and we went to a ramen restaurant. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it's over right by downtown Plymouth, right by Plymouth State and everything. And, we were looking at the foliage and everything. We went back by Route 25 and drove by Moulton Farm, and she wanted to stop and get some things from the farm stand there, which is more like a grocery store than anything else. And I decided that I'd grab an apple pie. So I've been experimenting and trying different toppings for apple pies.
I just have one question about that. How can anybody eat Cool Whip? Sorry, I have a problem.
At all?
With that.
Do you not like Cool Whip at all?
No, not at all.
I don't mind. I think Cool Whip's actually very good. Sometimes there's also the there's like the coconut stuff, like the Cool Whip, but it's made with coconut. That's really good, actually. I enjoy that a lot too.
Maybe I'm a purist. I figure if it's not whipped cream, I'd rather not have it. Thank you.
Well, I like whipped cream too and everything, but that's part. I mean, I've had with this apple pie now, and I'm about 2/3 of the way through. I don't eat it every day. I've had it for about I'd say a little under a week now, so I guess I have eaten a fair amount. But I've had I put a number of different toppings on it too. I mean, I mentioned I put Cool Whip on it. I've put whipped cream on it. I've put vanilla ice cream. I've put apple crisp vanilla ice cream. That was a flavor that they had Bailey's before. Bailey's Bubble just closed.
Oh, that sounds good.
But yeah, so having, you know, apple pie, but then also a vanilla ice cream with bits of apple crisp and apples in it. That was very good. I still need to try your suggestion of the maple syrup. One of my favorites, though, still is Vermont cheddar cheese melted on top, especially if I'm having the pie for breakfast.
My father was a cheddar cheese guy. I never quite understood that one either, but, you know, a lot of people do it.
You know, I guess it's an old New England thing for the most part, and I guess maybe some parts of Pennsylvania, but the expression goes, you know, apple pie without cheese is like a hug without a squeeze.
I hadn't heard that. I learned something today.
So I guess that's the old expression, and you know, there's the big debate, though, even within the, I guess we'll call it the cheese community, right? Those of us that put cheese, cheddar cheese on our apple pie, which is how do you nurture that combination, for lack of a better term? Some folks say baking the cheese into the pie is the way to do it, right? Some folks say putting the cheese on the side and, you know, taking a bite of pie and then taking a bite of cheese separately. I'm a believer in melting the cheese on top, putting, you know, you have the microwave, you have the pie that's, you know, kind of cooled off, obviously, because it's in the box I got from Moulton Farm. I don't bake my own pie. I'm not that, you know, much of a apple pie, you know, what's the word? I'm not that obsessed with apple pie that I'm going to bake my own, but I have had some very, you know, very good home-baked apple pies before in my life. But I'll take the pie, obviously, put it in the microwave. I'll put a slice of cheese on top. I'll, you know, put it in the microwave for about a minute, and, you know, you have a nice melted piece of cheese on top of your pie. And I really like it, though, because it balances out, you know, the sharp bite and almost the saltiness, too, of the cheese right, really goes well with the sweet and the mellow flavors of the pie. And then obviously the apples, they have a little bit of a tartness to them. So you're getting multiple flavors in one kind of in one kind of serving of a food. And I think that it all balances well because the cheese is typically not too overbearing. The pie filling itself isn't either. So it's a good flavor.
You know, I may have to try that for myself. It's been a very, very long time. But you know what? Since you put it that way, I think maybe we will take a look at it. Anyway, oh, by the way, I had one more suggestion, molasses.
Molasses?
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably a very old New England thing, too. New England's really well known for its molasses.
My grandmother used to give it to me in milk, which is, I love molasses. I really do. To the point where I can't keep it in the house because I'll just use it.
Molasses has always been molasses, and even more is rum. New England's been known for its rum, different drinks with rum in it.
That's very old. True. I remember those days when I did drink a lot of Captain Morgan spiced rum, but be that as it may. It is 12:08. Let's actually talk about something intelligent. Well, semi-intelligent anyway.
Pie is a very intelligent thing, actually. There's probably more people in this world who bake pie that do more useful things than politicians. So,
well, you know what? I think you're right. I'll give you that point. A lot more people appreciate pie. Anyway, one of the things I was hoping you could kind of sketch out for us is this current brouhaha with the executive council's vote on the vaccine money.
Yeah,
for those of you who haven't heard of it,
today too to talk about this. This is something that's had me fairly well torn, and I assume it has many. You know, it probably has a number of Republican officials fairly well torn. Obviously I'm a huge supporter of the governor, right? When I first ran, one of my biggest commitments that I made was, you know, no sales tax, no income tax. I wanted to create some amount of choice within our public education system without overburdening our public schools. I wanted to defend our Second Amendment, not only defend it, but expand it to its original intent, as our founding fathers put in the Constitution. But a huge thing, defend our, you know, our law enforcement, our police officers, stand with the thin blue line and other first responders like our EMTs and firefighters. And those are some very basic promises that I made. Well, there was another very basic promise that I made that was the easiest to follow. And I think one that people in Wolf are expecting, that's working with the governor, right? And I'm a huge fan of the governor. I think the governor is doing a great job. I think he's done a great job throughout his entire tenure as our governor of this state. COVID, you know, now what we're getting more towards post-COVID. We're not out of the wilderness yet, but we're getting to the point where we can almost say post-COVID. And, you know, I think many people are getting very excited for that. And, you know, people are getting vaccinated, which is great to see. But, It's very difficult, too, because I'm obviously a huge supporter of the executive counselor, Counselor Joe Kenney, and him and the governor have gone back and forth pretty direct at each other about this $27 million. And the $27 million specifically would have it was money that was going to help us increase our vaccination rate in this state. Specifically, it was going to be money that could be used for outreach to a number of communities that have the lowest vaccination rates. So one is some of this money could have been saved and used later on for once vaccines were federally approved for school-age children, right? And that's one of our largest, you know, when you think about percentage of people who can be vaccinated, school-age children they'll be the last group of people vaccinated because it takes a little bit longer for vaccines to get approved among school-age children. The kinds of the testing that these medical companies do take a lot longer. They're a lot more extensive, right, because we care a lot about our children in this country. So the only group of kids, you know, minors that can get vaccinated are people 16, 17, and 18 who have access to a Pfizer shot, right?
Right.
So getting access to a Pfizer shot for the general public isn't too difficult, even for 16, 17, 18-year-olds. But obviously then you have everyone 15 and under who, you know, and more specifically we could say 15 to 5 years old, in this state, those are school-age children. None of them can get access to a vaccine yet, right? It's just not possible. There's no vaccine that's been tested that we can say with 100% certainty that that's a vaccine that's safe for that group of people. Every other American, every other age group you know, the vaccine's perfectly fine and safe. We just, you know, we need more time to develop a vaccine for that age group. Another group is minority communities, right? Specifically, we see a number of these communities in Nashua and Manchester. They have a very low vaccination rate. The lowest vaccination rate amongst any group of Americans are African-American men, right? They have a very low vaccination rate, too. And so that might not be an issue that hits New Hampshire as hard because we're, you know, we're a fairly white state, right? We have very small minority community here. But even still, you know, that can affect our vaccination rates in the state. And then there's also the general group of folks who tend to be a little bit older and male who are just very, very vaccine skeptic, right? And so the point of this money was to advertise, to help advertise, to help promote how getting the vaccine safe, how people could go about doing it, what resources they can go to, and enabling and helping promote resources that these people would trust in doing research and, you know, putting out advertisements that would help with that. And that's what the $27 million was about. Now, there's a big discrepancy about whether or not this $27 million would have made it so then we would have to enforce any federal vaccine mandate. Right? That's kind of the whole crux of the big argument that happened between our Republican executive counselors and Governor Chris Sununu, right?
So that's the catch that went along with the money.
Yeah. So the attorney general said that there was no catch. He said there were some catches for how you were to spend that advertising money, but the catch that hung up people the most, which was that if New Hampshire took this $27 million, that we would have to follow all vaccine, you know, government mandates that would come out in the future. So not just previous ones, but any future ones. The attorney general said that that wasn't the case. Executive Counselors Kenny and Executive Counselor Gatsis both very much, no, actually, yeah, I think it was Executive Counselor Gatsis and also Executive Counselor Wheeler. He was also pretty open about it. They argued that the attorney general was incorrect. The way that they read it and the way that they interpret it, and having spoken to other legal counsel, that they were not of the belief that the attorney general's that his perspective, that his reading of the grant, you know, of the strings attached for these grants, these federal grants, that we would win in court saying that we don't have to uphold those vaccine mandates and everything. I think it's difficult to tell. Personally, I read the language. It seems, I think some folks might have cherry-picked some of the language, even on both sides of this kind of argument. But I think at the end of the day, though, the bigger concern that people had was the forced vaccinations that the federal government is imposing onto a number of states, but via OSHA and also via through our Medicare and Medicaid dollars, right? So that's how they've made it so then our governments have to impose it onto our government workers. And also OSHA is how they're doing it. You know, they're going through that process for the same results too, and everything. I'm not sure if this $27 million was going to capture us into anything because we already take federal dollars on a number of things. I think we are already at a certain point, you know, via whether it's, you know, through OSHA for our private businesses or whether it's through other federal dollars that can be used as carrot and stick for imposing other federal mandates. I think that ship's already sailed. I don't think the $27 million, even if the interpretation of the executive counselors is correct, that, you know, if we take this money, then we're beholden to all the federal government's rules. Based on how they're already implementing the COVID vaccine mandate amongst our government workers across this country, the Biden administration, it seemed to me that they already had the legal they already had the legal powers based on the money that we take as a state to impose a number of federal vaccine mandates onto granted staters. I don't think the $27 million was going to, whether we took it or not, was going to change that fact. And I think that the dollars were something that could be valuable to helping us increase our vaccination rate. And I also think because New Hampshire is a state that, we're a donor state. We give more in federal income taxes and federal taxes in general than we get back, right? We should try not to, and obviously within reason, but we should try not to pass up on opportunities when we can get more dollars into this state. Thus far, New Hampshire is the only state in America that didn't accept these dollars. Now, that may change, but I think if other states like, you know, Texas or et cetera, some very conservative states might end up taking, if they take these dollars, then I almost feel as if a reevaluation wouldn't be a terrible idea. Then again, I think the Executive Council does a great job when they look over these contracts. They're very frugal. They're very thoughtful. They do their due diligence. There might have been something in that contract and in those grants that they saw that were very glaring. Kevin Landrigan said on Jack Heath's show just before this, too, he mentioned that the only hang-up wasn't just, you know, having to carry out the vaccine mandates. There was actually a number of other things in it. Obviously, you know, when you write for the press, you try not to write wicked long articles. You try to keep your articles 300 to 500 words. That's one of the downsides to, you know, the way our press works. That's very much based on, you know, clickbait and social media and trying to get people's attention for about a minute or two. And then so they can move on to the next story to increase ad revenues and increase to increase clicks. But there was a number of other things that the Executive Council had problems with. And that's something I'm going to, you know, I'll reach out to our executive counselor as a state rep from Wolfboro, and I'll speak with the governor's office probably a little bit, and, you know, try to understand both sides of the argument a little bit more. But looking at it from this point, I'm not sure if our state can, you know, not sure if our state can avoid the vaccine mandates from the federal government. We can avoid having to impose those mandates. The Executive Council said, if we don't take this money, we don't have to carry out, we don't have to be imposing the mandate on our own citizens. We can let the federal government do it. And the governor's office, though, and specifically the AG, too, they disagreed. They said that we weren't going to have to impose those mandates on behalf of the federal government if we took this $27 million. But the $27 million is something that would have been very helpful to helping us increase our vaccination rates and help increase access to the vaccine for specific groups of people that are some of the lowest, have some of the lowest percentages of vaccination.
Now, is this the end of the matter, or can there be maybe a lawsuit to kind of define exactly whose position is right?
There's no way to have a lawsuit. You can get legal opinions, which is what our attorney general, that's like a huge part of his job, is giving a legal opinion to bureaucrats and to elected officials and telling us, you know, in my legal opinion, because the attorney general, you know, the way that his position set up in our state constitution and also in statutory law is he is like our legal counsel for elected officials and to represent the state, right? To represent the state and the people of New Hampshire, right? And so we very much defer to our attorney generals for their legal opinion on matters like this, right? We value it. It's important. And it's how we know, you know, that we can make good policy, that we're acting within the Constitution, of how to properly interpret the Constitution at different times and everything with different situations, you know, because sometimes you can really enter into a gray area depending on the public policy you're discussing or depending on the kind of issue that you're dealing with. And so the attorney general, actually, he's the person that we would turn to get their opinion on who's right.
Okay, that makes sense.
And the attorney general told us that the $27 million, that even with some of the strings attached, that it wasn't going to make it so that New Hampshire would have to, act out on behalf of the federal government to impose the federal government's vaccine mandate. Because the question isn't whether or not the federal government could have the vaccine mandate, right? It wasn't like if we accept these dollars, then New Hampshire has to follow the federal vaccine mandate, our granted staters. That's a different question that's going to be in front of federal courts over the coming months as the Biden administration, which they still haven't finalized what the OSHA guidelines will be and what the federal guidelines will be for, you know, municipalities and states for what the vaccine mandate exactly will be, right? But these dollars, the argument was that they would have made it so then we would have had to carry out and enforce, that's the biggest thing, enforce the mandate, right? And our executive council didn't want us, our state and our personnel, right, our state employees and police officers and et cetera, being the ones to enforce it, that the federal government would have to enforce their own rules that they're setting. right? AG's office said, no, even if we accept these dollars, we still don't have to enforce it. Executive Council said, it looks like we will have to enforce these vaccine mandates. No matter what, the federal government, they still need to tell us what exactly the mandates are, and we still need to find out whether or not they're constitutional, right? And so that's a separate question that's going to be answered in federal court. This question is whether or not we would be enforcing those mandates once decisions are made by our federal courts and by the federal government over, you know, what the mandate is and whether or not they're even, you know, allowable in federal statute and our and federal constitution. So we have a complex mess right now legally of trying to decide, you know, is the Biden administration's vaccine mandate, is it constitutional? And if so, do states have to enforce it? And if so, what if states don't want to enforce it? You know, what do they have to do to not enforce it? And if they do have to enforce it, how are they going to enforce it? And these are all questions the Biden administration hasn't answered. They threw out this concept without any plan and are now formulating a plan. And it seems very haphazardly, and I'm not sure how it's even going to really work, right? But, you know, long story short, there's going to be a lot of legal questions that are going to be asked over the next, you know, few months, because this may take, you know, another month or two to really figure out what the heck's going on and everything. And I know that there's a lot of workers in the state who are concerned about, you know, whether or not they're going to be able to still be employed, you know, a few months from now. And, you know, I think it'd be nice for the federal government to really, you know, finally step up, you know, after this Afghanistan boondoggle. And now with this whole, you know, this whole vaccine thing that's really starting to get out of hand and stuff, I'd really like to see some leadership from Washington. I'd like to see our federal delegation take some leadership and really, you know, help New Hampshire understand what's going on and where we are at this point with these things. Because I really do, as a state official, and I know other state officials feel this way, we feel left hung out to dry by the Biden administration and by our federal delegation that doesn't seem to be doing much except getting ready to campaign for the next election cycle. And that's a little disappointing.
Well, the part I don't understand is vaccine mandates are nothing new. Yes, there are exceptions for people who are dead set against them. You know, we haven't had this discussion, but the discussion has been going on about vaccinating for chickenpox and for measles, mumps, and rubella and diphtheria and all of those other things that a very small number of people don't vaccinate their children for. But on the other hand, unless you have an exemption, your kid can't go to school without it. And nobody seems to be protesting that.
Well, and that's the thing, is that that's going to start to change, too. I think there are people that are protesting that now, and they were such a small group, and now they're still a small group, but they're a louder and slightly bigger group, right? They're still a very small portion of the population, but I think, you know, they want to have a public debate, and that's more than fair. You know, public debate on any policy is something that we should invite, because that's how democracy works, and that's free speech. And it was, you know, John Stuart Mill that wrote in his treatise on liberty that unless you can welcome, you know, free and open dialogue in any subject, then you can't, you know, prove your point why you're correct or disprove someone else's point why they might be incorrect. And as a public, you can't learn, right? We know vaccine mandates have existed since before this country's inception. It was George Washington who actually imposed the first ever vaccine mandate on any American or any U.S. service member. He made it to the Continental Army, right? Our army that fought for this country's independence. He required smallpox vaccinations. And it was actually a huge reason why we were able to, despite having such a smaller number than the British, why we were able to win a number of battles and turn the war around after we lost New York City, because we were able to keep our troops healthier, right? And so, and we've had vaccination requirements, you know, and depending on the municipality and depending on different circumstances for a long time. And it was after the New Deal and after some major breakthroughs of vaccinations like the polio vaccine and the chickenpox vaccine that we started to see, you know, a lot more states take the reins and set their own vaccination schedules for children who attend public schools, right? And so most of our vaccination policies have been decided based on public health state workers and everything, people who work for our public health departments and everything, that after taking public input and after doing a number of studies and seeing the efficacy and the safety of vaccines, that decide what vaccines and when they should be taken for kids to attend school, right? And the federal government, you know, over those same years too, since World War II and after the New Deal, has also set vaccine requirements through carrot and stick technique, right? Where, for example, hospitals need to require a flu vaccine, and if they don't, they're not eligible for Medicare and Medicaid money, right? And a lot of hospitals, Medicare and Medicaid money helps increase their profit margins, or helps even make their hospital profitable, or at least not as much of a revenue loser, right? And so we've required a flu vaccine since the Obama administration now for about, I'd almost say, about a decade now. We've required a flu vaccine for any healthcare worker, right? You need to get a flu vaccine by a certain date, and, you know, hospitals are expected to impose that. And if you don't get your flu vaccine, then you have to take leave from work until you get your flu vaccine. So you are right, Eric. This idea that vaccine mandates are, you know, out of the realm of, you know, that this isn't normal, it's unorthodox, that's just not the case. Vaccine mandates have existed for a long time. Now, people are very skeptical about the COVID vaccine, right? People are very skeptical of the COVID vaccine, and they want the choice right now about whether or not they get the COVID vaccine. And I'm just not sure how mandating a vaccine onto the general population, you know, about what could be, depending on your state, 30 to 50% of the population, whether or not that mandate is actually going to be, you know, enforceable with such a large group of people, and whether or not people won't just quit their jobs and just take work where there are no vaccine mandates, right? Because obviously you can't mandate it for every single business, and obviously you can't mandate it for, you know, everyone. And obviously if people start working as independent contractors everywhere, you know, you can't at a certain point, you know, people will keep moving the goalposts, and the government won't be able to forever chase those goalposts. So it's very complex how it's all going to work out. It's very complex about, you know, obviously the COVID vaccine's safe, but there are folks who really don't want to have to get it. And, you know, I think we have to at a certain point, you know, we have to respect that too, right? We have to respect that. Even if we disagree, we have to respect that. And we have to figure out a way that we can talk to these folks and understand their reasoning, and, you know, maybe introduce them to a different way of considering this or thinking about it. So then we can, because I think that's going to be the best way that we increase vaccinations, right? I think the best way we're going to increase it isn't via mandates. I think it's going to be by talking with our family members, talking with our neighbors, you know, discussing this kind of stuff, saying to folks, you know, if you have a neighbor that you're very close with and they say, you know, I'm not getting the vaccine ever, and you say, well, you know, maybe I've gotten the vaccine, here's why I got it, if that gives you any kind of perspective. And if they still say no, then maybe, you know, you start a conversation with them a little bit more about it, more in depth. You know, you have a higher chance of landing in the ICU with COVID, and you also have a higher chance of dying from COVID than you do from the COVID vaccine. So, I mean, I took it because statistically speaking, right, even as a young person who has such a small percentage of dying of COVID and ending up in the ICU, I still had a higher percentage chance of dying from COVID and landing in the ICU than I did of having an adverse reaction and or dying from the COVID vaccine, which is wicked rare, extremely rare, right? Extremely rare. And I looked at that and I said, well, I'd rather not have COVID, right? Because if I got COVID, I, you know, you could have it anywhere from a week to a month or more. And I said, I have to work, right? I'm not going to hurt and hinder my income. And, you know, if I do get it, right, even if I get vaccinated, I know it's going to be a less time that I'm sick then, and it's going to be less extreme. And even more statistically speaking, right, getting the vaccine is going to decrease my chances of, you know, for me, it was a cost-benefit analysis. And I think that could be a good way to pitch it to people too. And that's another reason why the governor wanted that $27 million so much, was He wanted to be able to help, you know, increase our public advocacy and, you know, help bring that argument to people and help them see at least, you know, the perspective of public health officials of why the COVID vaccine is safe and why it's effective and why people should strongly consider it rather than going the mandate route. But and the executive counselors had in their opinion, they had a very legitimate reason for not wanting to enforce federal vaccine mandates, where they feared that, you know, did they want to be the ones who cast the vote that would force government workers and government bureaucrats to chase down Granite Staters and say, either get a vaccine or you're going to be fired and you're not going to be able to collect unemployment and, you know, you're not going to be able to pay your bill, right? It's a very tough decision to make. And, you know, and you have to respect both sides of the argument, right? Because no one wants to be forcing people to be unemployed, and no one wants to be, you know, putting people out on the, you know, no one wants to be putting them out of work, and no one wants them to be struggling to pay their bills. But at the same exact time, you know, we have to be cognizant of public health, right? We have to be cognizant of the fact that the vaccine's safe and that there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation out there about it, where people have, you know, been misled, and that's something that needs to be combated.
I agree, but I'm still struggling to understand the whys of the people who are vaccine hesitant. I respect it's their decision. I don't advocate shoving it down people's throats if they don't want it, but I don't understand why they wouldn't want it. That's the part where I'm just coming up snake eyes.
Yeah, I got it. I believe it's safe. I believe it's effective. I think our public health workers have done a good job helping keep New Hampshire's, you know, death rates extremely low compared to the rest of the country, helping decrease the spread, helping try and get us back to normal and everything. I think a lot of Americans are starting to get tired of all this, you know, the pandemic and everything. And I think they really want their fellow Americans to also get the vaccine. I think, you know, another thing too is President Trump, this was a huge undertaking that he began, was to get funding and to help him prepare for a vaccine rollout. And we have to remember 90% of the work was done by the time of the Biden administration, you know, took over, began their transition process, and then also began getting shots in the people's arms and everything. That was all legwork that had been being done for about 9 months under the Trump administration. And I think a lot of people need to remember that too, is that, you know, if they're skeptical of Joe Biden, they're skeptical because he wants them to get the shot and everything. They should maybe also take a look and understand that, you know, President Trump really wants them to get the shot. He's mentioned that at a number of rallies, you know, asking folks, you know, please consider getting the shot and everything. And he's also gotten a COVID-19 vaccine, even despite having previously had COVID-19, he consulted with his doctors and he got it. And he helped develop this vaccine with our private industry, you know, really, really, really empowering our private healthcare system in this country, right? And, you know, really empowering economic liberty and really empowering, you know, American ingenuity to make sure that this vaccine could be available to Americans. So I think that's something that people need to consider, is that they may not like Joe Biden. They may be skeptical of the entire Democratic Party. They may be skeptical of the entire media. They may be skeptical of public health officials. But a lot of those people who fall into all those categories are skeptical of all those kinds of groups of people. And the Biden administration, for the most part, most of them trust President Trump. And President Trump has gotten this shot. And President Trump helped develop this shot. And it was President Trump who was the one who has been an advocate for this shot too, right? And I know the press and the media, they'll never tell folks about that, but he has. He's come out publicly time and time again trying to encourage his supporters and trying to encourage folks across the country to help get this shot and to help get this country back on track and to help, you know, to help try to make America, you know, great again, right? And by doing that, getting the shot is one way to do that, right? And, you know, I think that's a compelling argument. And I'm hoping that there's some folks who are listening on the radio who have been, you know, wavering or trying to, you know, consider whether or not, or who weren't considering it, but just remembering that, you know, President Trump has been an advocate for getting it, right, by on your own personal volition of going to your doctor and considering getting it and possibly getting it, and also was a huge driving force of developing right, all these shots and helping make it so then we had such a strong supply of vaccines that we were able to share with the rest of the world and that we were able to be, you know, another bastion of American ingenuity, right?
Well, so far, so good. It does bring up a very interesting question. I know we've donated, what, at least 100 million doses to lower-income countries, but should we start rolling out these boosters because we can afford to pay for them when there are so many other parts of the world whose vaccination rates are really, really, really low?
That's a good question. I think when it's American tax dollars that invested and created these vaccines, when it's American tax dollars that are being used to transport them and get them to people, I think we have a responsibility, and I would even say an ethical responsibility because it's the American taxpayers' dollar, to ensure that every American who wants a vaccine and every American who wants a booster can get them no matter what. Now, that doesn't mean it's a zero-sum game. That doesn't mean that we have to give them all to Americans first, and then once we do a poll of every American, all 300, you know, 60 million of us, wherever many there are of us now, and, you know, once everyone says, okay, I'm good, I've got what I got, then we go to these third world countries and stuff and help them decrease their spread. I think we can do both at once. We can chew gum and walk. But I definitely think a prioritization of Americans is something that we need to do in this country, right? It's something that you know, there's another example. Former President Trump, he prioritized the American people and everything. And I think prioritizing, you know, Americans when it comes to vaccination is, it's first off, it's our, you know, it's our medical duty to public health. Right, making sure that the American public is healthy and safe, and it's our ethical responsibility because it's American taxpayer dollars, and we have, you know, it's our government should care for Americans first. But I also think, you know, with the amount of supply that we have of vaccinations and of the different components that make up vaccinations, I think we can do both at once. You know, fairly. You know, the American vaccination rate has started to kind of plateau for the most part. And I think that we can start exporting some of this stuff without having the concern that Americans aren't going to be able to get a vaccine. But prioritization should always be on Americans for any kind of policy, right? It should be, we should always be prioritizing the American people, should always be prioritizing using their taxpayer money in a safe, effective, and efficient way. And that should be how America's run, right? That's my strong, personally held opinion. And there is also an argument to be had, though, that, you know, the sooner we get vaccinations to a number of these third world countries, especially third world countries or, you know, poor developing countries that are important in our supply chains, right, that might help decrease inflation. And so that's something to consider, too, right, because obviously, you know, this inflation is killing Americans right now, right, and D.C. has no answer for it other than printing more dollars and trying to spend this $3.5 trillion project. And inflation is a tax. It's right up and in your face. We're seeing it, you know, with clothing, food stuff, gas. I mean, look, price of gas now is increasing again. It's only going to keep increasing until after New Year's, right? And we may see gas prices start to get close to $4 pretty soon, and there's no answer, right? The Biden administration finally decided that they were going to do something about the backlog of ships in California. They couldn't get the port. It only took them a month to come up with some kind of plan, right? And it's like, you know, we need, I hold this to this strongly, right? In New Hampshire, we've led the way on the pandemic, right? We've led the way. Governor Sununu has prioritized public health. Governor Sununu has helped us through this. New Hampshire Republicans have, you know, understanding inflation's going to hit people's pocketbooks and it's going to hurt small businesses. We decrease spending on the state level, right? We had the state tighten its belt, not grant staters. We decreased the business profits tax. We decreased the BET. We gave more state revenue and state aid to our municipalities, right? We're going to work to decrease property taxes too and working with municipalities. But at the end of the day, it's municipalities that need to really take that strong leadership role too. And we've really led New Hampshire, right? We've really led New Hampshire to help fight against this inflation, to fight against the pandemic and keep working and keep marching forward despite the federal government's failures. And I'm just hoping that, you know, the current administration and our current federal delegation st- steps up down in D.C. and that D.C. does something, because the 603, we can't do it all alone. We can do a lot of it on our own, right? And we're trying. But D.C.'s got to step up, be leaders, and help us solve some of these things and answer some of our unanswered questions.
Well, one of the unanswered questions is what's going to happen as of the 3rd of December. I know that's not really your area of expertise, but maybe you can kind of simplify this down. Is, I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, not only is the government only funded through the 3rd of December, the debt ceiling should be hit right around there as well.
Look, and I'll tell you why part of this isn't really my expertise. Well, one, because I'm a state official, but two, because I vote for balanced budgets. Promise I made to the people of Wolfboro, whether it's on the county level or whether it's in Concord, right? On the county level, we balanced our budget without increasing taxes, and we didn't decrease necessary services. Same exact thing with Concord. We decreased spending by 3%, got rid of government waste, and didn't decrease the services provided to Granite Staters, and didn't decrease essential services provided to our seniors, people with disabilities, children, single mothers, right? We preserved all that. We managed to decrease spending. We managed to decrease taxes, and we're still seeing revenues increase so we can make more future investments for Granite Staters, right? Washington, D.C. needs to take some notes from the 603 on what it means to balance a budget, to increase revenues, and to make strong investments in municipalities and in Granite Staters, and to decrease property taxes, and to increase economic liberty, and to increase opportunity for everyone. In D.C., they're too busy worried about protecting the bipartisan, monolithic, outrageous spending that's going on down there. And again, it's a failure of leadership from our federal delegation. It's a failure of leadership from folks in D.C. It's a failure of leadership from both parties, quite frankly, right? Someone's got to sit these folks down, these knuckleheads, and, you know, teach them how to balance a budget, teach them how to find government waste in a budget. I know we have a lot of great Granite Staters, you know, a lot of great representatives who sit on our finance committees, like Karen Umberger up in Conway, who could definitely sit them down and give them a quick lesson on how to balance budgets and how to, you know, effectively allocate resources to maximize the public good for Americans.
The last time we had a balanced budget was in the 90s, if I remember right, under the Clinton administration. Has that ship sailed, or do you think that we'll have balanced budgets again soon?
It sailed with the current people in D.C., yeah. It sailed with the current people in D.C. The people in D.C. who are there right now, who a lot of them have been there 10, 20 years, and even some of the new people, they're more worried about fundraising. They're more worried about reelection. They're more worried about their bottom line. They're more worried about preserving the status quo, and they're less worried about serving the American people. We have to, as Americans, look at the next election cycle and even look past party in a number of times and say, who are the people within my political party, or who are the people just in general, who are going to put service above partisanship, who are going to carry out the will of the American people, and who are going to be the best people to move this country forward? Because right now, we're at a gridlock and a stalemate. Feels like it's been that way for about 15 years, right?
Yeah.
We need new blood. We need new blood that's going to, it's not even that they need to shake up the establishment, because, you know, some of those people too say, I'm going down there to shake up the establishment. You know what they are? They're just a big bunch of crud and leaves behind a log that's clogging up the stream, half of them, right? You know, we hear them all the time. I'm going to go down and shake up the system. They go down and they quote unquote shake up the system, and they just look like buffoons, right? What we need is, we need workhorses, not show horses. We need people that aren't worried about political buzz phrases, people who are worried about putting in the time and the work to serve the American people. And specifically, I'm thinking about New Hampshire, too, to serve Granite State, right? I agreed with Governor Chris Sununu when he said we should fire them all, right? We should fire them all, right? Any American that's looking at their incumbent, unless their incumbent has a very compelling reason why they've effectively worked for the American people and how they've been able to build bridges and to get things done with anybody who's willing to work with them, and how they've stood on a number of basic principles, right? Balancing the budget, decreasing taxes, maximizing economic and personal liberty, protecting the Second Amendment, right? There's a few things that, you know, as Republicans that we stand on, but there's other things that we have to look at, like the budget, and say, the budget's such a large, complex, you know, machine, if you will, for lack of a better term. There's a bunch of inner working gears and widgets and things, and we have to look at it. We can't just, you know, we can't have one monolithic answer for it, right? We have to be accommodating. We have to be understanding. We have to listen to stakeholders. We got to work across the aisle on some things. We have to be honest. We have to listen to our constituents on it. I've never, ever seen anyone in our federal delegation, currently in our federal delegation, before a budget vote, come to New Hampshire and hold a town hall and ask folks what they thought about the budget, what they thought about the spending.
Never.
Irresponsible. Never. Irresponsible. At least in my life. At least since I've been following politics when I was in high school, right? Since I was about 14. That's about 8 years now. In the 8 years that I've followed politics closely, right, very closely, been involved in the New Hampshire Republican Party, which was in high school starting 14, 15 years old in the last 8 to 7 years, I have never seen anyone even explain why they voted for the budget before the fact. Something I did was I solicited to the general public via Facebook and via radio. I said to folks, I said, I want to know what you think about the budget, right? I want to know what your opinion is, right? And I got some people that gave me their opinion, right? And actually, most of them wanted to see the budget pass. And I had people call me who didn't even see my solicit, and they told me I want to see the budget pass. But, you know, the folks in D.C., they're just not listening to us because they're more worried about reelection. They're more worried about the bottom line that's going to help them. And that's just, you know, in my opinion, that's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. It's about public service, right? It's not about public self-service. And we need to get this country back on track. And, you know, I think people need to be really looking at these primaries that are coming up in the Republican Party, right? And people need to be really taking a close look at who's currently serving for us in Washington, D.C. We've got to really think about who is prioritizing people in New Hampshire, and then how are they then going to prioritize people of America, and how are they going to solve problems, and then what are their basic principles? What are things that they're standing on that they're not compromising on, right? You got to look at those four things. What are they going to do for the district? What are they going to do for the state? What are they going to do for America, right? What do they want to get done? Who are they willing to work with to get that done? And then what are their basic principles, right? What's the core of who they are and what they believe in?
Okay. It is 12:50 here on WASR. We're talking with Brody DeShays, capably filling in for Jeb Bradley this afternoon. I hope everything's all right in your world. Cloudy today, and probably some rain either late tonight or tomorrow. We'll give you those details coming up in just a few minutes. One of the things I don't understand is, as you say, fire them all, as the governor has also said. Well, that's great, but why?
Governor might have been serious about that. I'm more hyperbolic. I know you can't fire them all, right?
I understand that. But what, I mean, why does the incumbent have such a huge advantage then? You'd think that in this day and age where approval ratings in general are very low.
I'll give you one answer because I know we have 10 minutes here and I want you to try to get a few more questions. Incumbency advantage because they have more name recognition and they can fundraise more because they're sitting on committees and they're able to solicit for donations from the lobbyists that expect them to be sitting there and helping them rather than them serving Granite Staters. That's why. That's the one answer, right? You serve an office, you get more connections to people who are donors, you get more connections with people who are lobbyists that lobby on behalf of specific industries, sectors, and special interest groups, or even ideological groups like progressive or libertarian or conservative or liberal groups, right? You're able to build those connections so you can get more money, and people already know you, right? You've been on a ballot before. They've seen you on the ballot before, and some people will vote based on the name that they recognize. That's the reality of it. It's one of the issues in a democracy, right? You can raise more money and make it so then that your message is out more, and if you can make it so then that your name's more recognizable. I love the expression, you know, and I can't remember who coined it, but I love saying it all the time where people say, you know, why is Concord broken or why is Washington, D.C. broken? And I'll tell everyone listening right now, it's broken because we voted for the Congress that we deserve, right? We have the Congress that we deserve, and it's on us. It's on us, people of New Hampshire, people of Congressional District 1, people of Wolfboro, Carroll County, and all Americans, right? It's on all of us to really do our homework and to vet political candidates running for office, right? We have to do a better job of vetting these people, finding out who they are, what their background is, what they've done in their past, what they want to do in the future, and if they're actually sincere in their words for how they're going to serve, right? I feel as if I've been very sincere when I told people when I campaigned, right? And I tell people all the time, you say, I'm not happy with that decision that you made. Sorry for that. You know, I've told people I want to try to build as many bridges as I can in Concord, but I did make a common set of promises, and they're all on my website, right? BrodyForWolfboro.com. I made a very basic set of promises, and I've stuck to those promises, right? And that's a huge thing for me, right? When I make a promise, I fulfill it. I'm also, you know, when it comes to outside of those promises, I'm willing to work across the aisle. That's why I helped start a group of about 36 lawmakers, half of them Republicans, half of them Democrats, right? 18 of us that we try to work together. And, you know, while we disagree vehemently on a number of issues, we put those issues aside that we stand on principle and that we've made promises to our constituents on, and we move past that. We try to find places of agreement, right? It's just about building bridges, because people expect that, because it's, like I said, public service first. It's not self-service. There's a lot of people who go to Concord or who go to D.C., and it's self-service to their specific ideology, and they believe that they have all the answers because of their certain specific set of political beliefs. And that just can't be the case, right? In a democracy, no one holds the dictatorship on the truth. That's just, it's incomprehensible when I see folks that say, you know, there's only one way to do this, and it's based on my set of beliefs. It's like, there's no way. There's no way for a democracy to work without some give and take and without some compromise. That's not to say that people shouldn't stand on a certain set of principles when they go to Concord. It's just to say they have to understand that when they stand on those principles, right, that they have to look at other people's principles and look at their perspective and then try to find a way to solve issues facing grandstanders.
Well, bipartisanship isn't dead, but it at least at the state level, but it sure looks pretty dead on the federal level.
Looks dead. Actually, I'd say bipartisanship's working better at the federal level than the state level. State
How
level
do you figure?
Is dead as heck, but at least on the federal level, they could come up with a bipartisan infrastructure plan. Now, that's going to be killed because the progressives, for some reason, they're one of those groups of people. They believe that they hold the dictatorship on truth by sheer existence of their adherence to an ideology, right? But in Concord, it's been tough. It's been tough to try to work across. You know, there's some folks who, they frown upon it. They frown upon the fact that you would sit down with a Democrat and try to solve an issue. I believe that we have an issue in our schools in this state with the kind of food that they serve, the kind of food that they serve to our students. I don't think it's good enough quality. I've introduced three bills that are going to help improve nutritional standards and improve children's meals within our school systems across the state. Worked across the aisle with Democrats on it. I've worked with Republicans on it. It's not a partisan issue.
Well, it's hard to bring partisanship.
I'm afraid that even Concord, that something as simple as that will end up becoming a partisan issue, or at the very least that there will be people who are colleagues within my party who will frown upon my willingness to try to solve this problem. That's just the nature of it, and it's too bad. It really, in my opinion, really is too bad. I wish that on some basic issues that we could put, you know, partisanship aside. I think we've done a great job on the county putting partisanship aside. We didn't increase taxes. We didn't increase spending. We were able to maximize investments. We were able to make more investments in our nonprofits in this county that are going to be helping people, you know, deal with mental health and domestic violence issues throughout our county. Issues that are increasing now that COVID's over, and now that, you know, things are reopening, people are now trying to get away from those abusers and are now trying to get the mental health help that they need and everything. And nearly everything that we passed on the county, I would say actually quite literally everything, was passed in a bipartisan vote, almost unanimous, because we just worked together, right? We understood that, you know, as a Republican delegation, and Democrats understood it too, that, you know, there's a lot more that we agree on than we might disagree on, right? And, you know, when we can effectively work together, that's better for the people of Carroll County than when we're too busy bickering, right? And some folks might prefer the bickering, and I would hope that their constituents look real closely at the next election cycle and say, am I sending you to Concord or to Carroll County to bicker, or am I sending you to serve me, right? And that's, again, to go back to that point that I've made multiple times now, is that this is public service, not self-service. Is someone more worried about their self-service, serving themselves, their political beliefs, their ideology, or their reelection? Or are they more worried about making sure that we can maximize investments, you know, effectively serve people in New Hampshire and do it as frugally as we can, right? That should be the goal of government, right? How can you maximize your investments for the least amount of dollars needed to make those investments? How can you make it so these long-term investments save taxpayers money, and so then you can maximize revenues in the future and make other investments or further decrease taxes? That should always be the goal of people running government. I think New Hampshire Republicans have done a great job. I think on the county, we've done a great job doing it in a bipartisan way. And I'm hoping that more people will be joining and helping with those goals, and that more people will try to put aside, you know, some of their self-serving beliefs and prioritize service.
Is this that old expression, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely? Is that one of the reasons why things get stuck?
Probably. the way things work. I mean, you also have to consider, too, the way our system works is if you're in a safe district, you're rewarded for being a little bit more extreme and pandering to one specific ideology. And you also, you know, if you can do that very effectively, you sit in that seat for a long time. The longer you sit in that seat, the more likely you are to end up on a leadership position within a party. And this is true within both parties. So the people who run the parties in D.C. or, yeah, I would even, you know, say even maybe to a certain extent in Concord, less so in Concord, but it's becoming more common in Concord, where people who have served the longest live in the reddest or the bluest districts. They only have to worry about primary. So if they ever get primary, they just have to shift themselves farther right or farther left, more towards, you know, the farther extreme of the political spectrum. And as long as they just fend off primaries, then they're good and they get to lead the party. And that can be an issue. That's part of the issue why we have so much gridlock. And part of the issue, and it goes back to what I said earlier, is we voted for the Congress that we deserve, and it's on us, all of us, right? Even elected officials, too, because we also vote. It's on all of us to look at who we're voting for and to really ask ourselves, is this person prioritizing service? Or are they prioritizing themselves and their ideology? And how are they going to serve us once they get down there if they do prioritize service? And what's the best, you know, what are they really all about and what's their history, right? What kind of organizations and groups have they been involved in? And so I encourage all grantsters, we're getting towards the end here, and I have to hop on a business call actually at 1 o'clock right now, which I just turned over to. But we have to make sure that as voters that we're paying attention to who's on the ballot, what they're going to do for us. We have to make sure that folks care about their communities, their constituents, and how to make government not only, you know, not only smaller, not only more effective, but better.
All right. Thank you very much, Brody. I appreciate you filling in. I know you have that call, so I'll let you go, and we'll talk next week.
All right. Take care, Eric.
All right. Take care. It is 101 News is next.